Now the Clausens are turning toward each other and toward Joy. I ask them, besides this law, what's new?
We spontaneously got a new puppy a couple of weeks ago. It was the most impulsive puppy adoption ever.
Impulsive puppy adoption.
And it was totally worth it.
I asked Beth how our listeners could get involved.
Talking to their legislators. They don't have to understand what it means to be transgender or to have a transgender child, but they need to talk to their legislators about how wrong it is for them to be making decisions for people's children. There's doctors for that reason. They are not doctors.
She says another thing anyone can do is support organizations that help trans kids and also speaking up.
And telling people that we are all on the same side. We all love our kids and we all want what's best for them. If we could just get that message across.
Great. Is there anything else you think I should know?
Kieran would like to show you the puppy, if that's okay.
Oh my gosh, yes. Show me the puppy. Oh, she's huge. Oh my gosh.
She's yeah. not very cuddly. Right
yeah,
now.
But we named her Socks.
What?
Because her front two paws.
I get it. Very cute.
I'm Amy Gastelum. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. Next week, we will continue the conversation with Dr. Maisha Price and get into one factor that may help Black, trans, and non-binary youth, particularly from suicidality.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Laura Wadlin, with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Our topic is what to do when your union leaders break your heart. Our guest this evening is Ellen David Friedman, a retired organizer for the Vermont National Education Association and a member of the Labor Notes Board. Thanks for joining us.
I'm totally delighted to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Some of our listeners may have read an article you wrote on this very topic, what to do when your union leaders break your heart, in the Labor Notes magazine, or our listeners may have participated in a monthly workshop sponsored by Labor Notes on this topic led by you. So
the article published a few years ago in the Stewards Corner starts, quote, if you're a union member, unfortunately, the chances are good that you've had or will have your heart broken at least once by one of your own leaders, unquote. So can you give us some examples of what you mean by that?
Unfortunately, the examples are almost infinite. I'm very sad to say that I and many of my colleagues in Labor Notes are often approached by people saying things like this. Well, I'm new in the union, but I'm really interested. And so I started trying to go to meetings, but like I couldn't find meetings. And then I tried to find who my steward was, but no one would tell me who the steward was. And anyway, finally I found like an officer, and they brushed me off, or they were dismissive or arrogant or patronizing with me, or they were suspicious about me. So there's kind of that response of like, I just want to get involved with my union, but they won't let me. I don't know how. And then many, many more serious things, including charges of very serious corruption, both financial corruption, money taking, financial malfeasance. And with lack of transparency, many union members are not able to even find out what are the terms that are being negotiated in a collective bargaining agreement. They don't know what's happening at the table. Meetings are held in executive session. They can't get minutes to their meeting. So there's problems with transparency, with corruption, certainly with lack of democracy. And then the other most heartbreaking thing is we really need to fight. Things are bad. They're bad for me. They're bad for my coworkers. And our union seems to be doing nothing about that. So these are some of the varieties of heartbreak that we often encounter.
You go on to say in the article, if you're bursting with organizing ideas and union leaders shut you down, often it's not because they hate you. More likely, your ideas make no sense to them. Can you talk about this and how we got here in the labor movement?
Indeed. This has become something that I'm become quite clear about over the last number of years, which is we have had a set of conditions bearing on the development of our labor movement, particularly since the late 1970s, which we sometimes refer to as neoliberalism. But neoliberalism has a lot of different projects that it undertakes. Often, you know, people think of it as being a system that is designed to reestablish control by elites and for elites, which it has done certainly in the economic sphere, but it has also really committed itself to hollowing out our democratic organizations, such as our unions, also our political parties, public governance agencies. So how I have come to understand it is this, that virtually every U.S. union to one degree or another, certainly since the late 70s or early 80s, has become ever more bureaucratic, ever more hierarchical, ever more top-down, ever more focused on politicians, on electing Democrats to office no matter what, expecting the politicians to do our work for us, which of course they mostly do not do. There has been active, for many years, demobilization of the members, as if the members are nothing more than customers buying an insurance policy. And so since most of our unions are like that, the people who come into leadership in those unions reflect that as what they should be doing. They should be administering an organization that bargains a contract, kind of, and then enforces it or not, kind of, in a very bureaucratic way. But this is their idea of what a union is and should be. So when rank and filers, as we call them in labor notes, when troublemakers come along, we say, wait a minute, the member should be informed. We should be educated. We should be engaged. We should take charge of this union. We should use this union to really fight and win important things for ourselves and for the class. These leaders are often incredibly threatened, not only because they don't like those ideas, but they really don't understand. They don't think that's what unions are for. So it makes for a pretty serious miscommunication often.
A major subhead in your article is about a culture of secrecy. You touched on this a little bit already, but explain what you mean by that and give us some examples of culture of secrecy.
Since I began working as an organizer in the labor movement, which is really from the mid-1970s, there were certain received wisdom, certain things that were considered to be absolutely unchallengeable norms. And one of them was that collective bargaining needed to be conducted in great secrecy, conditions of high confidentiality, up to and including sometimes that the bargaining team did not even reveal to members what was being bargained for. And then you would get, if you got updates at all, the updates would kind of be, we had a frank discussion on Article 7, Subsection 2, and made some preliminary progress. Those kind of reports, which of course are absolutely meaningless. And there is a lot of rationale for that. There is a lot of justification for it that mostly ends up being bargaining is a technical skill that only few of us, mostly lawyers or very experienced negotiators, are capable of doing. The rest of you don't really understand it. That's one justification. The second is we can't let the employer know what our actual plans are, because if they know our plans, it'll completely, you know, weaken us, our strategy. You know, to which I always say, yeah, our plans have to be really secret. Like, workers want better wages. They want they want better benefits. They want better staffing so they can do their work. They want more education. They want better health and safety. Yeah, these are really have to be tightly held secrets. So anyway, that kind of attitude of secrecy has the intended result, actually, which is it cuts members out. They don't know anything. They feel ill-equipped. They don't even know what questions to ask. And so they stay away. And then the only thing they hear, if they're lucky, is after 8 months or 2 years of bargaining in the dark, they say, here's the tentative agreement, and you better vote for it, because if you don't vote for it, we're going to get something much worse. So this really disempowers, demobilizes, and shows absolutely no respect for the intelligence, the engagement of the members, and the fact that it's the members' contract. It does not belong to the lawyers who negotiate it. Often the officers, bigger unions, they're on release time. So now their wages and benefits are very different than the members. So this secrecy is a big problem. The other prime example is around grievances. And again, the received wisdom is grievances really have to be kept in confidence. In fact, that's not true. There is nothing that says, there's a law that says when you are dealing with violations of the collective bargaining agreement, trying to resolve them through grievances, that they have to be kept in secret. Well, of course, you use your judgment. And if there's an individual who has something very, very personal, very sensitive involved in a grievance, you ask them, would you prefer to keep this in confidence? And they may say yes. But in all other cases, I have always felt, of course we should be talking about the grievances. They should be very open, because otherwise, how do we know what the boss is doing? And members should be well informed about the boss's behavior so that they can make good decisions about how to resist that bad behavior. So I could go on and on, but those are the two prime examples of secrecy that really weaken us.
In your article, you go on to encourage the reader to recommit to their union and take responsibility for changing the culture and changing the future of their union. You say, the first step is to get past disappointment and despair, commit to action. So how should one get started in this situation?
Yeah, well, this is part of why I offered the title to the article, which was kind of a provocative title, you know, what to do when your union leaders break your heart. It is provocative because it acknowledges something that many union members know is true, but no one is supposed to say out loud, which is we are being failed. So I took the chance to give the article this title, and we do a monthly workshop, online workshop through Labor Notes. I've been doing this for a few years with the same title, because first and foremost, I wanted people to hear you are not alone. This is something that is happening to many, perhaps millions of people, certainly tens of thousands of people. are feeling this way. So it's a sign of respect, and also to help people get past this idea that, oh, maybe it's something about me, maybe I'm doing something wrong, or I'm the only one this is happening to. So it allows people immediately to feel you are part of a group, which is quite important.
If you've just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOO Portland. We're listening to Ellen David Friedman about what to do when your union leaders break your heart. This is community radio, listener-sponsored, and non-corporate. So if you can, you enjoy this, you get something from Labor Radio, please donate. Go to the kboo.fm/give. You're advised readers, quote, if you get a sense that others share your heartbreak, get yourself ready to talk directly with your union leaders. Mm-hmm. Talk about how to do that.
Well, this, I have to say, this piece of advice is a little controversial among some of my my colleagues, because some people will say, look, if you're in this kind of a union that has broken your heart, there's no point talking to the officers because they've already decided what they're doing. My attitude is, maybe, but you don't know. And they may actually just not have had the opportunity to think about what they're doing in a different way. So give it a try. Don't write them off without at least attempting to have a productive interaction with them. And they're, depending on what your union is, what the industry is, what the size of the workforce is and the local, whether you are dealing with trying to deal with leaders at local level or state or regional level or district level or national level, will change how you make this approach. But a few pieces of advice prevail. One, never do it by yourself. Never do it as an individual. If you're thinking about going to communicate with an officer, either face-to-face or in an email or through a petition, well, that's a little bit more aggressive. But, you know, find coworkers who share your ideas, and we'll do this with you. It's important both because it bolsters your confidence, and also it will show you and coworkers how they respond. You know, if they totally shut you down, if they insult you, if they get angry, if they accuse you of being anti-union, which they might do, because any disloyalty is sometimes judged to be anti-union, you will have other witnesses, because what you're doing, of course, is not anti-union. It is the most pro-union thing you can do. You're trying to make your union better. Do it with others. Be concrete. Offer very specific instances in which I observed this. You know, for example, I read our bylaws, and our bylaws say that there should be a general membership meeting every month, and that it should be warned to members. The agenda should be warned at least 5 days in advance. And we have not had a union meeting for the last 2.5 years. And so I'm concerned about that. And I talked about it with my steward, and my steward said they didn't know anything about it. And so now we're coming to talk to you about it. So be concrete and specific, and make sure that any question you ask or any charge you make is firmly grounded in reality. Show respect. I don't mean suck up. We should never suck up to anyone under any circumstances for any reason. We should be respectful to officers in the same way we are respectful to each other and ourselves. Dignity is important, but that doesn't mean fear, and it certainly does not mean pandering. Be respectful. Make concrete suggestions. You know, because we haven't had a meeting for 2.5 years, and because I see in the bylaws we should be having one, we are asking you to call a membership meeting. We're asking that the agenda be posted 5 days in advance. And we have some items we would like to put on the agenda. Can you commit to that? So make requests that are achievable. and something like that should be achievable. So that is some other advice, you know, giving people sort of the benefit of the doubt. And if you don't really think you see eye to eye with them, but also do not let this go on too long. Your officers should be held to some accounts, and if you have brought your case, made a complaint, made a request, these are all reasonable, and you are being ignored or denied or pushed off or something, then you can make a different plan. But I don't think it hurts to take that step first.
The last section of the article is titled Consider a Caucus. Tell us about that path.
Yeah, of course. Caucuses are simply groups of union members that find each other. It is not an official group within the union. It is an independent, self-initiated, self-organized group of union members who find each other and begin to talk because they are dissatisfied with something about how the union is working and would like to change. Generally, we find the dissatisfactions are either lack of transparency, lack of democracy, or lack of militancy, you know, the willingness to fight the boss. Those tend to be the big areas that will motivate people to try and start a caucus. Caucuses can then move in any direction you want. There's no rules, but I will say to any listeners that caucuses are legally protected activity. The LMRDA, the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, federal law that governs all private sector unions, is very clear and says it has within it something called the Union Members Bill of Rights, or that's how we refer to it. And within it, it says that union members have a right to disagree with leadership, and they have a right to talk to each other and to form dissenting groups, and they have a right to run against their officers. Anyway, so they can take many different directions. Some caucuses pretty much only do internal education. They'll have reading groups. They will read the contract, or they'll read the bylaws and constitution to get members informed. They may read books. They read Labor Notes books. Democracy is Power is one of my favorite Labor Notes books, and many caucuses start by reading that, or Secrets of a Successful Organizer, or the book How to Jumpstart Your Union, which is a book that we wrote about the caucus in the Chicago Teachers Union that was formed 10, 15 years ago and has very, very successfully transformed that union, which is, I think, the third largest teachers union in the country, in tremendously important ways. So some will do just education. Others will decide that they want to get involved in bargaining in some ways. So they may encourage or try and motivate people to run for the bargaining. They may try to open up bargaining in various ways. They may motivate the creation of contract action teams. Maybe the union has been pretty sleepy about any contract campaign, and so often a caucus will get involved in that process. Sometimes they'll start a newsletter. If there is one, they might get involved with that and make it a little bit more useful, or they might start a new one. Sometimes caucus members decide to run for office. This is a whole question. Should you? If so, when? How? Why? We deal with this a lot with people. The caucuses can be quite formal. There are some caucuses, for example, inside our largest union local in the United States, which is the United Federation of Teachers. It's the New York City Teachers Union with about 125,000 members, has a very mature, well-established caucus called MORE, the Movement of Rank and File Educators, and they collect dues, and they have formal membership, and they run an entire series of internal education including something they call, I think, UFT boot camp, where they are teaching union members things about the union that the union will not teach them because they don't want the members to know. They have run for office some years, elected some people to their e-board, and some years they decide not to run. So varies. We have, especially the caucuses are very advanced within the K-12 teacher sector. And we have a national network of caucuses, which we refer to as CORE. It's just a network. It's not really an organization. Well, the United Caucuses of Rank and File Educators. And there are many groups that participate in this network. Some have office or in leadership, such as Chicago, Baltimore, Seattle, San Antonio, Texas, the state of Massachusetts. So there are some that have won leadership and transformed their unions in that way, sort of from top down in a certain way, and many, many more that are transforming their unions from the bottom up. So the last, I will also say that caucuses have now come back. But the last time caucuses were an important feature of the U.S. labor movement was in the 1970s. And that's when I came into the labor movement, so I've always thought they're a very natural part of our movement. They help keep all union officers accountable, even if they are elected from the caucus slate. They still need to be held accountable, but also there are things that caucuses can do that union leadership cannot. You know, union officers have to run a union. That's a big job. They got to bargain contracts and enforce them, and they got financial obligations. Caucuses are free of all of that. Caucuses can just focus on educating members, recruiting members, helping them develop and advancing reform projects. So anyway, the last thing I'll say is that caucuses have now really become a feature again of our movement. Everybody's familiar, many people I'm sure, with TDU, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, probably familiar with UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy within the UAW, that was instrumental in helping to throw corrupt leaders in jail a few years ago and then elect Sean Fain and a slate both nationally and at district level. And there are caucuses starting up in many, many, many other unions, which is a beautiful thing to see.
You said many caucuses start by reading Democracy is Power, and the caucus in my union started by reading Democracy is Power.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yes, so I can say you are very right about that.
That's great.
So finally, can you tell our listeners how they can learn more about what to do when your union leaders break your heart, and about the next Labor Notes workshop, and how people can stay in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually pretty easy. So Labor Notes runs this workshop on the first Tuesday of the month. It starts, it's always at the same time, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 7:30 to 9. It is always on the Labor Notes website on the events page. If you have signed up for Labor Notes, whatever the newsletter or the e-blasts are called, signing up for updates, you'll receive it. There'll be a notice sent generally 2 weeks before with a registration link. Registration is free. I think some of our workshops have a small charge, $10, something like that. I believe this one is still offered for free. It is extremely open. We often have somewhere around 100 on average, somewhere around 100 people come every month. Some people come back every month, but a lot of people will just come in when they can, when they got a problem they want to address. You don't have, it's mostly dialogic, so mostly I just ask people to talk about what their heartbreak is, and then we all try and help them think about it. It has been productive. We hear from many people that that's kind of how they started thinking about what they could do. We often offer this workshop, which when your union leaders break your heart, at our national conferences, which happen every 2 years. Our next national conference is June 2026 in Chicago. But we also every year run some number, I don't know, 15, 20, 25, I'm not sure the number, but troublemaker schools around the country. These are one day kind of mini labor notes conferences by region, and we hold them in all over the country in different cities, and sometimes it's offered there. The books are good. The books help. And then the other thing that people can do is if you are, we pretty much always say, you just want to talk to someone, just get in touch with Labor Notes. Like someone's going to talk to you. We have a staff that is also spread out all over the country and have different beats. You know, so some work on Teamsters, some work on with educators, some work with healthcare. And anyway, we try and cover all the industries and all the unions. And then we have other people like me, just retired, you know, board members and others in our network. So you can call and say, can someone talk with me? If you are specifically interested, you're in an industry and you want to know, who are the other people? Are there other people in my industry that have started a caucus? How can I get in touch with them? We help people do that all the time. We serve as a platform for a lot of national networks. So, for example, as Jamie knows, there has been a platform through Labor Notes for postal workers of different unions. There is a platform, there's a national network for rail workers who are also in 5 or 6 different unions, and they've come together. Educators, higher education, healthcare, IATSE, there's a lot going on in the entertainment industry, and we can help you connect with other people. We all